Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and you have all heard of the Shudder series, Cursed Films. My guest today is writer, director, editor for that series, Jay Cheel. Welcome, sir.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good. What can you tell us about how this series came to be?
Well, the series was brought to me by Shudder. And before I worked on Cursed Films, I had done a short documentary called Twisted, which looked at another urban legend connected to a film where I grew up in Niagara. There was a drive-in theater and it was hit by a tornado, and supposedly this tornado blew through a screen that was playing the movie Twister at the time. And so it's a story that's kind of been around for quite some time, and the kind of thing where everybody knows somebody that was there and claims they saw it happen. So I, you know, interviewed those people and talked to the people working at the drive-in and tried to get to the core of that story. And it ultimately kind of became a short film about the nature of memory, and unintentionally worked as kind of a proof of concept for Cursed Films, or at least my take on it, which we always kind of described as a series that explores the tension between the rational and irrational. So Shudder was into that take, and we ended up making it.
Now, was Cursed Films always going to be an episodic presentation rather than one sort of anthology documentary film?
Yeah, it was always episodic, but it did at the start begin as three episodes with two films per episode. But after our first block of filming, we realized that there was a lot of story to tell and it made more sense to split them up. So we did five episodes and dedicated each episode to one film. And that worked for us, and it's the similar format we're going to follow with the next season. So there was a little bit of a shift in production, but I think it was for the better.
Cool. Now, for season one, the movies are The Exorcist, Poltergeist, The Crow, Twilight Zone the movie, and The Omen. Was that always the set lineup going in, or did you guys pick which movies, you know, like, we don't know which ones we're going to talk about. Let's start with these three. Let's find a couple more. How was that selection process handled?
We did have a long list of films that seemed to be talked about online and, you know, the movies that most people would associate with a cursed film production. And I think ultimately we landed on those five because it felt like it was a good variety of stories. I didn't want anything where the legends connected to the films felt too similar. And I think those five films gave us a nice arc throughout the series. And also they're kind of like the greatest hits of, you know, cursed film stories. I think they're the ones that most people think of when you mentioned the idea of cursed films. And I know for myself as a horror fan, I grew up hearing about definitely the stories connected to Poltergeist and The Exorcist and certainly The Crow. That was a film that landed at a very formative time for me. So it made sense to me and Shudder that was the five that we were going to start with.
Now, were those always going to focus just on horror movies, or is there a specific type of mystery or aura around the films that made you choose them?
They were always going to be horror films. The Crow is kind of horror adjacent, I guess. But it seems like that aura that you're talking about usually is connected to horror films. I mean, there are some non-horror movies that are considered cursed productions, and those are interesting as well, but for the sake of the first season, I think we were, at least I was very interested in exploring why horror films specifically seem to, you know, perpetuate these sort of stories, and why the ones connected to the horror films seem to be the ones that rise to the surface, rather than, you know, whatever tragic accidents or challenges might be faced on during while filming a comedy, say. So that was definitely part of the game plan when planning for the series, is just to kind of tackle that and learn something, a little something about horror as well, and ourselves as horror fans.
Mm-hmm. I saw and noticed this thread through all five of the episodes where some of the guests are talking about the masses latching on to the mystery, the curse, the problems plaguing the production. And I realize, I'm like, there should have been an opening episode focusing on just what makes people latch on to superstition or curses around certain high-profile horror movies, because that sort of reaction on a grander audience scale has always fascinated me. And mm-hmm. I think there's a story there that needs to be told.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we, throughout the five episodes, you know, we kind of try to cover as much of that as we can. And I know on Shudder, when they were first released, the order was kind of mixed up a little bit because of the premiere of The Exorcist, the film, on the service. So they started with The Exorcist episode as the first episode of the series. And that was not intended, that sort of lineup. The intent was to start with the Poltergeist episode, which I think sort of sets things up a little better, and not only the idea of a cursed film and where this comes from and why we're fascinated by it, but also the tone of the series, which is supposed to be playful when necessary, skeptical when necessary, but also open-minded and very concerned with paying tribute and being respectful to those who were affected by these stories. So, you know, one thing nice about the Blu-ray that's coming out is the order of the series is back into that form. So I've kind of been saying it's, you know, not a director's cut release, but it's a director's order release of the series. So people can finally see it in the right order. But yeah, there's a lot to be discussed there for sure.
Okay, so the Blu-ray comes out on August 18th. What is the preferred director's order that's on the disc?
This would be horrible if I forget. Poltergeist, The Omen, The Exorcist, The Crow, and Twilight Zone, the movie.
Okay, cool. Now, each of the episodes has a commentary track by you, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Now, does that...
Amazingly entertaining commentary tracks, I must say.
I am a huge fan of commentary tracks because there are little gems buried in there that most people don't even realize till years later. So is there a through line that continuity that carries through all five episodes, or are you just each commentary is just for that episode?
I mean, in terms of the commentaries, they're just for that episode. And it's mostly, you know, talking about the goal of the series and the intent and the experience of sitting down with the people I spoke with and some behind the scenes stories. I mean, you can imagine it was a pretty fun series to shoot, especially for a horror fan, getting to sit down and speak with other horror fans about some of our favorite films and getting to meet the people who worked on those films and picking their brain about their experiences and and even off camera having conversations about other movies that they worked on. So it was a really great experience. So, you know, I try to share some of that on the commentary track, and you know, that's why I'm also excited to get back out there to film the second season, because it's hopefully just going to be more of that great experience with, you know, a little global pandemic added into the mix.
Well, we will talk a little bit about season two in a minute, but I would like to know for you personally, which of those first season five movies did you discover new stuff or more interesting stuff that you hadn't known before? Which for you was that sublime surprise?
Well, I mean, I think although I had heard a lot of the stories connected to The Omen, I think hearing them all lined up back to back was kind of a mind bender, because there's just so many crazy things that happen on that production, and getting to hear Richard Donner stuff in a way that felt like it gave some credence to some of these insane claims. That was definitely a surprise. But with the Exorcist episode, the whole Paul Bateson, you know, real life killer in The Exorcist was something that was new to me. I had not heard that story before, and I hadn't seen it on that many of the lists that are online, you know, detailing all of the things, weird things that happened connected to the film. So that was an interesting discovery for us. And getting to speak with Barton Lane, who is the man who performs the angiogram in the film, which I still think is one of the most effective and unsettling scenes in the movie. And exploring that little side story, it was just like this unexpected little piece of true crime amongst all of these other weird things that happened during the making of the film. So that was a pleasant surprise, as much as a true crime can be a pleasant surprise, I guess.
So recently we had the news that Cursed Films was renewed for a season two, and I expect you're eagerly looking forward to starting that. I know you can't tell us which films are on your short list, but what are you looking forward to doing in season two that may have been different or improved on from season one?
Well, I mean, I think I'm excited about the collection of films, first of all, because I feel like it's a very eclectic, diverse collection of movies, and all of them feel very, very different. Like they will provide unique angles and voices and experiences. So that excites me. And the idea of traveling outside of North America is going to be interesting. So, you know, covering some films that have more of a international perspective. But in terms of the actual series, I mean, I feel like with the first season, we really dug into the idea of a curse, a supernatural curse, and what that means in regards to a film being cursed and why we're fascinated by that. So I don't want to repeat that again. So I think it's really going to be even more about allowing the voices of those connected directly to the productions to speak to their own experiences. Because I think with season one, for myself, that was always the most those were the most valuable conversations, getting to hear those honest perspectives without any sort of agenda being applied to the interview. You know, like we never went into it saying, okay, the show is called Cursed Film, so if you could kind of humor us by, you know, not flat out denying that this might have been cursed and kind of playing along. We never approached it that way. We always just wanted people to talk about it openly and honestly. And if they feel that it's not a curse, then that's their opinion. And 99.9% of the people have that opinion. So with this season, I really want to just focus in on the challenges of making the films that we're covering and the stories that came from them. And again, how the people connected to those films feel that legacy or those legends interface with the legacy of the film itself, and how that kind of lines up with their own personal experience on the set. Because, you know, I think there are some cases, obviously, where a film is extremely challenging and everyone leaves that experience feeling beat down. But there are also some experiences where that challenge might have provided some sort of feeling of growth or some sort of bigger epiphany about something, you know, much broader. And I think that's where we want to kind of go with this series and treat each episode as hopefully a sort of definitive shorter documentary about the production of those movies from a true documentary perspective.
Was there ever any thought to focusing on a specific region, say like all of, you know, covering the horror movies of South Korea or the paranormal supernatural movies of Mexico, investigating any weird happenstances around just films from a single other region?
There won't be episodes dedicated to that, but some of the films we cover will definitely get into that territory through the lens of the specific films that we look at. So we'll definitely be hopefully not just talking about those places, but going to those places as well and you know, doing some of our own investigating.
Cool. Well, we will leave off of season two before you say anything to get you into any trouble, but how hopeful are you that this will continue for like a season three and a season four? I mean, are you still looking forward to investigating more weirdness around horror films or supernatural films?
I mean, my feeling is that as long as there is an interesting story connected to those productions and we can access great voices to tell those stories, then I think there's value to that. I wouldn't want to get to a point where it's an obligation or we're attempting to create something out of nothing. But certainly I feel like even the films that just have had extreme challenges, like you look at Apocalypse Now and the documentary Hearts of Darkness, and while you could say that film seems cursed, or I'm sure the people working on it probably said at times, you know, it feels like we're cursed, there's also just that element of, you know, the meaning of curse just simply being an ill-fated production, you know, it just a lineup of weird, unlucky circumstances that lead the crew to having to face these challenges that they've never faced before. And I think there's something inherently interesting and dramatic about that. And the tension that arises from that is interesting, especially when you contrast it to what ultimately ends up on the screen. Because I feel like with some films, you can sense that struggle, but there are other films where you watch it and it might feel like, you know, there's no feeling of any sort of challenges or tragedies connected to that work. So that's another interesting aspect of it, is how those events and those challenges ultimately shape the actual film itself. So I guess, you know, the short answer is just there's definitely more stories to tell, and my involvement would always have to be from the perspective of maintaining, you know, a good sense of story and character.
So what type of stories do you find the most entertaining? And is that an element that you look for in the story you want to tell?
Well, I mean, for in terms of things that I watch and I find entertaining, I like a lot of traditional classic storytelling that everyone else enjoys, and you know, it works for a reason. But I'm kind of a person who is more intrigued by character rather than plot, I guess. So I like great character-driven films that don't necessarily have to be moving some ball along where we're, you know, having to follow some overly complicated plot line, like, you know, a James Bond film or something, even though I do like some of the James Bond films. But I do like a stripped-down narrative that allows you to spend more time with getting to know the people who are on screen rather than keeping track of details that concern nothing but, you know, a plot line or a MacGuffin or so that's kind of my sweet spot. But I mean, I guess that's probably reflected in my own work as well, where a lot of my documentaries are character focused rather than I guess subject focused. Like documentaries are always, I think, unfairly aligned with advocacy films, and there are a lot of important documentaries that have done a lot of great work introducing people to various subjects of interest and important you know, issues that we should be paying attention to. But there's also a whole other side of nonfiction filmmaking that is a very personal one and speaks more to the human condition or a universal truth about ourselves. And those are the ones that I'm interested in making. And I think that Cursed Films kind of aligns with that. You know, it's kind of a nice balance between sharing all of the crazy stories that happen on the sets of these films, but ultimately filtering that through the perspective of some great people who are willing to be open and honest about their own experiences.
Well, as someone who is a fan of the 3.5 hour long and 4 hour long documentaries about Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street, there's plenty of deep diving that can be done with a dedicated team of fans of those films, because 4 hours of documentary had to have started out as 60 hours at some point in time.
Yeah.
But so where can people find you online to keep track of any developments that come along for season two?
Well, I'm on Letterboxd, which is the, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but sort of movie watching social media site. So I am on there. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter, but it's deactivated right now just so I can keep my sanity during the pandemic. I'm sure at some point I'll reactivate once, you know, we start promoting season two. I co-host a podcast called the Film Junk Podcast, which is like it sounds, it's a film podcast where me and my two co-hosts, Sean and Frank, discuss new releases every week, and also a bunch of older films that we watch in our own time. And we believe that it's the longest running movie podcast on the internet. I'm fairly certain that we have that distinction. We started in January of 2005, so we've been going for about 15 years at this point. So that's kind of our you know, as people get older, it's harder to get together and hang out. So that's the way we do it. We just record this podcast every week. So you can find that at filmjunk.com.
Cool. Definitely have links to all of that. Well, Jay, thank you so much for bringing us an interesting documentary idea and braving those potentially cursed airwaves to bring it to us.
Yeah. hopefully, you know, it's the joke that always runs through the production, but hopefully we don't end up being a cursed production ourselves.
You can find Cursed on Shudder. The Blu-ray DVD comes out on August 18th at your favorite online or physical retailers, wherever you feel safest to venture to get yourself a copy. And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Slice of Sci-Fi.
The lonely alien pet bravely waits for the family that may never return. An astronaut with seconds to live discovers just how good victory can taste. A mecha pilot and an aristocrat strike up an unlikely friendship. Take a ride with Escape Pod, the Hugo-nominated weekly science fiction podcast, at escapepod.org. Every week will launch you into an alternate reality, so buckle up, it's story time.
Hi, welcome back to more Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guest now is Mitch Horowitz, an author and historian of mysticism, the occult, alternative spirituality, and other items you might find in the field of esoteric thought. And he is one of the commentators, one of the co-hosts of Shudder's docuseries, Cursed Films. Hi, Mitch. How are you?
I'm great. Good to be here.
Now, my big question is, how did you get involved with Cursed Films? Because this is not a connection I would have initially have made. It makes sense when you think of it afterwards, but how did you get pulled into this project?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because although I studied the occult and esoterica, I'm not what you would call a cinemaphile. I'm not a historian of film. But the director, Jay Cheel, asked me to become part of the project because he's dealing with this theme of cursed films from a critical perspective. You know, he's asking the question of whether there's really any such thing as a curse, or is that just a fantasy, just a category that we dream up in order to bring a sense of order to a very chaotic world? And he already had a couple of participants in the project who were speaking from a perspective of hardcore skepticism. And he wanted to bring in my voice because I tend to approach these topics with a critical sympathy. I don't believe that these films were cursed. I believe these films were beset by tragedies and accidents that Jay and the series does a good job of tracing out the forensics of. But if you were to ask me, is there any such thing as a curse? I might say, well, let's unpack that gently. Let's unpack that with a bit of a question, because I do believe that there's an extra physical dimension to life. I take seriously questions of belief, whether mainstream or alternative. And I certainly approach the matter critically, but not dismissively. And I think he wanted that voice as part of the series.
Cool. So what did you think of the series and what it was trying to do from your perspective as someone who studies the esoteric and the occult?
Well, I thought that the series did an extraordinary job of tracing out the forensics behind some of these tragedies, like the death of Brandon Lee and the accidents and deaths that occurred on the set of The Twilight Zone, including the actor Vic Morrow and two child actors who were with him on the set and were tragically killed. I think that for some of the people involved in these movies, some of the special effects folks, some of the actors, some of the filmmakers themselves, this was a tremendously cathartic experience, because for them, it's deeply frustrating to encounter a kind of sensationalistic rendering of what happened on the sets of these films. For example, the death of Brandon Lee being shot accidentally on the set of The Crow was traumatic for everybody involved. And rather than perpetuating some kind of mythology around it, the series walks through the forensics of exactly what happened, the lapses in judgment, the lapses in responsibility among some people whose job it was to keep him safe, that contributed to his death. So I think the series just does an extraordinary job of picking apart the forensics of how tragedies can occur. Sometimes they're just blind accidents, but sometimes they're foreseeable, and they're foreseeable because people act with hubris and they cut corners in matters of safety. And that's part of the sub-story of this series.
Yeah, I had always known that Brandon Lee's death was an accident with a prop gun, but I never realized that later they traced it back to a cost-cutting move by the studio to get rid of the experienced weapons master and hire someone locally who didn't have as much experience, and tragedy occurs. I'm like, yeah, cutting corners tends to not go well. I never knew that second part of it.
Yeah, you absolutely nailed it. There's a social dimension to these things. You know, there was a unionized worker, an expert who was the weapons master, as you said, on the set. Costs were cut. Some secondary person was brought in, and a horrible accident occurred. You know, it's funny. I mean, we sometimes, of course, we do meet with accidents. You know, something falls from the sky, and that's that. But very often in life, these things are traceable. And I think the series does a wonderful job of demonstrating that.
Which of the movies covered in the series piqued your interest in how quickly or how easily people ran to the, oh my God, this is cursed story?
For me, it was The Exorcist. And that's the episode that opens the series on Shudder. I am fascinated with The Exorcist and with other popular horror films of that era because starting, I would say, in the late 1960s, early 1970s, horror not only took a turn where it became more humanistic and it began to expose different things about human foibles, human personality flaws, but it also really came to coincide with people's beliefs. Most of us walking around today know what an exorcism is. We have some point of view, perhaps, on exorcists or so-called demon possession. And yet, most of what we think we know does come from that movie. Whether a person has seen that movie or not, everything that he or she is walking around thinking about in terms of exorcism has that movie as its antecedent. And in fact, here in the United States today, and it's an absolute true stat, over the past 10 years or so, the number of Catholic Church sanctioned exorcists has quintupled.
What?
And that's just over the past few years. Yeah, hard to believe, isn't it? Absolutely true. And immediately everybody asks, what's going on? You know, what's the story with this? And of course, you know, if you ask conservative folk within the church, they'll blame people like me. You know, it's the New Agers' fault. You know, everybody's going out and playing with Ouija boards. Thanks a lot, Horowitz. You know, and others will talk about sociological reasons, reasons of insecurity, and so on and so forth. Whatever the reasons may be, the fact is, I really believe that if it wasn't for the release of The Exorcist, most of us would not even know that word today. It would be a crossword puzzle term. It would be one of those things that would very rarely get used, just as you didn't really start to hear the term vampire in American life until after Bram Stoker. You know, people knew what a vampire was, but it wasn't something that was on everyone's mind. You know, everybody, you know, was you know, had a mind's eye picture that was relatively similar. It was a very arcane concept. It's only after these things are brought to us through horror movies that they come to coincide with belief. So The Exorcist really has spawned a significant culture of belief in this country, whether people know it or not, whether people have seen it or not. You know, that film became part of our religious outlook. So I'm fascinated by the coincidence between horror and as a category and spiritual belief.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around the fact that so many people decided that they wanted to become exorcists, and the church sanctioned that many. I mean, are most of them American? Is this a global thing?
It's a global thing, but there's been an uptick in America more than anywhere else. Most of them are, there are priests within the church who have been trained within the exorcism rite. The exorcism rite within the Catholic Church is written in Latin. It is copyrighted. They do not want it to be passed around. They don't want anybody posting it on the internet. It's one of the most closely guarded rituals within the Catholic Church. Now, you also have a bunch of people here in the United States and elsewhere who classify themselves as exorcists, but they're of a freelance variety. And one such figure also appears in that episode. And so you'll have people who refer to themselves as exorcists or demonologists or what have you, who are just lay people, who are freelancers, so to speak. And then you'll have church-sanctioned folk who are priests and who are performing the actual exorcism rite in Latin. And I was shocked when I learned about it, and it's really just fascinating. There's many reasons for it, you know, and part of the reason is, you know, all of this began years ago under the papacy of Pope John Paul II. Pope John Paul, although he's thought of as a very conservative pope, was also a very mystical figure. Mysticism and conservatism really overlap in the church in a lot of ways. And he wanted there to be more in the way of exorcisms and saint veneration and things of that nature. So this is, I think, part of a belated ripple effect coming out of his papacy.
That just fascinates me to no end, because I remember seeing The Exorcist. It was probably the second or third horror movie I saw as a teenager, and I was like, really? And most of my family lived in the DC area, so when the media sensation around, you know, that staircase came up, we're like, yeah, we know where that is.
Can you imagine? Yeah. it really, truly, there are primeval themes in that film that really get under the skin, And look, you know, maybe it's not wrong that people view a movie as a religious experience. You know, I have a friend, Michael Muhammad Knight, great writer. He converted to Islam after seeing Spike Lee's film Malcolm X, and he asked himself the question, can a movie be a kind of sacred experience? And I believe the answer is yes. Anything can be a sacred experience if it touches into some kind of primeval need or themes in a person. My takeaway of The Exorcist is very different from the takeaway that devoutly religious folk might have, by which I mean religious folk in a mainstream sense. But I can understand, you know, how a movie could affect somebody's religious attitudes.
So how would you compare the reaction to The Exorcist to the reaction to The Omen, which also that dovetails right into Christian, I guess, history?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question, because, and this gets to some really uncomfortable beliefs or prejudices in our society. It's really weird. You had child actors in both movies, Linda Blair, who of course played Reagan in The Exorcist, and a young man, young British actor, who played Damien in The Omen. After The Exorcist was released, Linda Blair, who's this 10-year-old kid, begins to experience harassment, threatening phone calls. She needs to have bodyguards. People, some subset of people, watch this movie, and they feel that there's something evil and malevolent about this kid, this young girl, who obviously is just playing a part. The young man who played Damien in The Omen, he experiences no such threats. No bodyguards, no threats, no nothing. Now, of course, you could say, well, you know, The Exorcist is a more profane movie, and that's certainly true. But it does pose an interesting question: why these two actors, who are both in some way placed into a scenario where they are evil incarnate, you know, whether through possession or whether, you know, through being the son of the devil or what have you, And both are obviously placed into positions where they're meant to creep out the audience. Yes, The Exorcist is a more profane movie. No question about that. But the reaction is that you have this subset of people who believe Linda Blair is evil, and they're following her and endangering her. And this other kid, you know, more or less gets a pass. It's an interesting comment on our culture. You know, I'm not sure I'm fully qualified to unpack that, but I've really noticed that.
I would venture a theory, And yeah. this is just my my theory of how fans react to movies. Those movies came out in the 70s, pre-internet, and Linda Blair lived in the U.S., where it was very easy at the time to look up somebody's location, their details, and get to them in America. And I'm drawing a blank on his name. The kid from The Omen was British. He's in England. Yes. There wasn't quite so open a way to find people like that because of the history of protecting the privacy of the royals. So
that's very interesting.
The press back then, or still, would, you know, there's a lot of hoops you have to jump through. It wasn't quite as easy to track people down. And he's in England. There weren't a lot of crackpots in the U.S. who were going to, like, long-distance calls to the U.K. to harass a kid.
We are officially crazier than they are. I am persuaded of that.
Yes, yes.
I think there's more wing nuts in the United States. I have no numbers to back that up, but that's just my personal takeaway.
I will not disagree with you on that.
Yeah, yeah. And the actor who played Damien Thorne was Harvey Spencer Stevens. And he went on to what I presume was a relatively happy childhood in England. But Linda Blair had intruders, and it must be frightening when you're 10 years old, 11 years old, and you have people directing that kind of attention at you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just puts in mind the old William Shatner Saturday Night Live skit, "It's just a TV show."
And I'm actually glad you brought up William Shatner, because this demonstrates how we experience horror. You know, nobody watches William Shatner and thinks he's really Captain Kirk, not even some little subset of wingnuts. We might love him, you know, we might get carried away, but we understand its artifice. But people watch a movie like The Exorcist, they're really impacted by it. Another fact is the applications to enter the priesthood, seminary applications, spiked for several years after the release of The Exorcist. It's a very powerful experience for a lot of people, yeah, because the character in that film of Father Damien is sort of this young, masculine, heroic character. You know, it's maybe one of the first times that a Catholic priest had been depicted on screen, you know, in this way. You know, he's a boxer, you know, he's sensitive, he's tough, he's a hero, he's self-sacrificing, and it romanticized the priesthood for and more young men wanted to flow into seminaries after that.
Oh, so fascinating. So
yeah.
What do you believe in your, you know, professional opinion? What causes so many people to latch on to mishaps around a film and decide, you know, this is a curse? What leads people down that path?
I think in the case of these movies that are covered in this season of Cursed, it's a story of human tragedy, accidents, hubris, foreseeable and avoidable tragedies in some cases, but it does get reprocessed in the public mind as a series of curses because we experience horror from a perspective of belief as a culture, whether we say so or not. Obviously, some of us are hardened skeptics and we look at this and we say, look, you know, I know this is fantasy, and as much as an episode of Star Trek is fantasy. And that's certainly true for a lot of people. But there are other subsets of people for whom these are reflections or dramatizations of things that they believe are absolutely true. And there are beliefs we hold in this society today, such as attitudes about demonic possession, that probably would be really obscure and very secondary in our culture if it wasn't for these movies and these works of entertainment. So I think that the unspoken truth around the horror genre is that it is probably the genre of entertainment that most fully coincides with belief in American life.
Do you think that might be connected to the feelings horror movies are supposed to invoke in the audiences?
I do. I mean, the themes are just so primeval. You know, if you look at, for example, well, Dracula. I mean, that for most people, the original Dracula starring Bela Lugosi, it's the classic battle between good and evil. There's not a lot of nuance in it. You know, we know who the good guys are. We know who the bad guys are. And within the Western religious framework, we have been raised that way. You know, there's God and there's Satan. There's heaven and there's the underworld. And there's not a lot of nuance there. And so we see that reflected in the movie. In Frankenstein, we see the hubris of humanity trying to replicate itself, trying to recreate itself. And of course, Mary Shelley entitled her original novel, The New Prometheus. Prometheus, who stole fire from the gods and enlightened humanity in Greek myth, is also seen as a kind of prototype Satan figure. You know, there's this idea that, you know, the good people are on the side of God and creation and the heavens, and the bad people, even if they're tragic, even if they're not entirely unlikable, like Victor Frankenstein, you know, they're the ones who are messing with the natural order of things. They're going to get all of us in trouble. So I think that that Western religious mindset, it really repeats throughout almost all of our horror films.
Never thought of it before, but there's sort of a connection with the Garden of Eden, because until humans learned more about the world around them, they were innocent, they were protected, and now they're on their own.
Yes. Yes, you nailed it. You nailed it. I mean, in some ways, Victor Frankenstein is like the snake in the Garden of Eden, and he's punished and he suffers for this attempt to unlock the mysteries of creation and place them in the hands of humanity. And it's a fascinating story, you know, and these are themes that Mary Shelley was exploring, you know, more than a century earlier. And it's really at the heart of religious tension, you know, in the West. We're told in scripture, we're created in the image of God himself. And yet, well, does it stand to reason then that Victor Frankenstein is just following his destiny, or is he violating his destiny? Which is it? You know, it's a big tension in Western life, even if it's unspoken.
How about with the movie Poltergeist and the connections to historically what has happened in the past? People who are greedy or cheap or both move headstones from a cemetery and don't move the bodies, and the connection with, you know, the afterlife. And even now today, there are still issues with people developing land that had been Native American burial grounds.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's fascinating. I mean, most of us watch Poltergeist, obviously, and we don't think that a clown doll is going to come to life and try to strangle us, although, you know, probably we do move the clown doll from the bedroom, which is an interesting facet of human nature. But the film obviously does have a moral parable. You know, these people built this beautiful new tract housing development on top of an Indian burial ground, and their refusal to honor the past, their refusal to honor the memory of these lives that were taken, obviously results in catastrophe. So, you know, it begs us to ask, what are we as a society turning away from? Or more intimately, what are we as individuals turning away from? You know, what debts have we not paid? You know, it's easier for us, in a sense, to frame these things in a societal manner and thereby evade responsibility. So as to say, yeah, someone ought to do something about that. Someone ought to get on top of that. You know, but what things do we do in our own life that are the moral equivalent, where we don't pay our debts to somebody? We don't recognize what ground, you know, we're standing on top of. So in that sense, you know, all questions of curses aside, a Poltergeist is an important moral parable.
So for you, what was the most fun to learn or discover about any of these movies during the making of season one?
During the making of season one, I would say I can't classify it as fun because it was ghastly, but I was fascinated with the forensics that were reassembled around the Twilight Zone movie, where the actor Vic Morrow and two young kids were just tragically killed in an accident on set that, as Jay and as the series demonstrates, was completely avoidable. They could have used dummies, they could have used body doubles, they could have, you know, shot this final scene from different angles, and yet explosions, a helicopter, the destruction of a Vietnamese village. All of this was depicted on screen, you know, Cecil B. DeMille style. And it may be very romantic to think, yeah, I want to do it like Cecil B. DeMille did it. But it did put people in the way of unnecessary danger. And the tragedy was as appalling as it was avoidable. And I think the footage that appears in that episode, it just made an indelible impression on me. And it was used so conservatively. You know, I mean, there's some really graphic footage out there. And what the episode shows is quite conservative and respectful. But even that footage alone, it'll haunt you. It'll simply haunt you.
Yeah, I don't think I had ever seen it before until this episode. And hearing the one special effects guy who had been helping to maintain the safety space around the explosions, his reaction, I mean, today you can tell that still affects him. And he knows that this was hubris and stupidity combined.
Yeah, yeah. And in that sense, my assumption would be that the series is cathartic for some of the people involved, because these obviously were incidents that scarred people for the rest of their lives, incidents that took people's lives. And I think it's probably cathartic that these events are not presented in a sensationalistic way, but are really examined at the core as the result of corner-cutting, accidents, hubris, predictable problems that could have been averted. I hope they feel some sense that their story has been appropriately told.
I hope so, too. Well, this series, Cursed Films, has been approved for a season 2, which delights me to no end. Are you going to be involved in that, or can you say yet?
I can't say yet. You know, that's all sort of an open road, and I know that the movies picked are a bit of a secret. Even I don't know all of them, mm-hmm. but it's going to be really exciting.
Cool. And where can people find you online, just in case they have questions?
Sure thing. My website is MitchHorowitz.com. I'm on Twitter at Mitch Horowitz, and on Instagram at MitchHorowitz23.
Awesome. Well, Cursed Films is available now on Shudder and will be available on DVD Blu-ray on August 18th. Mitch, thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. A pleasure.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this. And Cursed Films is available on Shudder if you are subscribed to that service. And if not, the DVD and Blu-ray will be available on August 18th, available from your favorite retailers. And my curiosity is pegged at trying to even guess at what films they will cover in season 2, especially since they said it'd be a more of an international flavor. So I am really curious now. I can't wait to see what those are, and I can't wait to check them out when they are available. But if you have more questions for Mitch and for Jay, follow the links to their social medias and ask away. But if you have any questions or comments for me here, the number to use is 602-635-6976, or you can shoot me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Player FM, and iHeartRadio Podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple or Stitcher, you can leave us a review. Let other folks know that you are enjoying the show, and perhaps they should check it out for themselves. You can follow us on Twitter, @SliceOfSciFi. We're also Slice of Sci-Fi over on YouTube. Check us out there. And on Facebook as well, Slice of Sci-Fi. And of course, there's the website, SliceOfSciFi.com. Come on by, check out our other interviews, reviews, other tidbits of television and movie news that you might find interesting. And you can also weigh in with your own perspective and comments and ratings on the reviews that we have done. I'd like to thank everyone who is currently supporting Slice of Sci-Fi and all of the other podcasts in the Slice of Sci-Fi universe. Your support really does help keep things going around here. If you'd like to add your support, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. Or if a monthly pledge commitment is not in your budget at the moment, but you still want to help, the link to use is paypal.me/sci-fi-summer. One other thing of note, people who are Patreon supporters, your email gets tossed into a barrel every month, and one lucky patron gets to choose from having a perk sent their way. Could be a free DVD, a free Blu-ray, a free book. The choice is yours if you are selected. It's my way of saying thank you to all of the people who are supporting, because I get plenty of materials to peruse and review, and for space reasons, I can't keep all of it. Therefore, I share with the people who enjoy this show and the content on the website that I hope you're enjoying. It's my way of giving back to all of you who have continued to support Slice of Sci-Fi for 15 years now. So thank you all. And yes, not only are we closing in on episode 950, we're within sight of episode 1000. I don't know what to do with a 4-digit episode number. But fortunately, I don't have to worry about that until next year. So, I wonder if that matters a lot. Probably not. Anyway, that'll do it for this episode. Thank you all so much for listening. And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.